There's a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. Producer Darren, push the button.
What's trending in Trumplandia?
So yesterday, former attorney for Donald Trump as candidate and as business person, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison for his role in paying women to keep quiet about their alleged affairs with President Trump. And it means, according to some, that the president's in trouble. In fact, when you listen to some of the arguments being made by federal prosecutors, you might say, seems inevitable that the president is going to find himself in some trouble. Sure, he can't be indicted as a sitting president, but once he's gone, once he's out of office, it's anyone's game. Here's Judge Andrew Napolitano on Fox News.
Career prosecutors here in New York City have evidence that the president of the United States committed a felony by ordering and paying Michael Cohen to break the law. How do we know that? They told that to the federal judge. Under the rules, they can't tell that to a federal judge unless they actually have that hardcore evidence. Under the rules, they can't tell that to a federal judge unless they intend to do something with that evidence. The U.S. attorney in Manhattan, a Donald Trump appointee, taking a page from Jeff Sessions' book, recused himself, leaving this case in the hands of the full-time career professional prosecutors. They are the ones who prosecuted Michael Cohen. They are the ones who told the federal judge that Donald Trump orchestrated these unlawful payments. They are the ones who made the agreement with AMI, the parent company of the National Enquirer, which ties a bow on all of this.
It does to a point, but the truth is we don't know the context of the evidence because there would need to be criminal intent in order for them to prosecute President Trump. The president has basically said, and he said this out on Twitter, hey, I was told something very specific from my lawyer. It's called on advice of counsel. And he's implying that he was told what he was doing was perfectly legal. And if that's true, and Michael Cohen says, yeah, I told him it was legal, or there's any evidence to suggest that there was clearly no criminal intent, well, they're not going to be able to indict President Trump. They're not going to be able to go after him. A felony then wasn't committed to the degree in which we would actually have a trial. And we certainly know that it doesn't come nearly close enough, not even remarkable, not even a little bit close to the idea of an impeachable offense, no matter what Congressman Denny Heck of Tacoma tells you. It doesn't come anywhere near that. We had Ann Bremner on the line in the 7 o'clock hour, Seattle attorney, brilliant attorney and legal analyst. And she said she's looking at what's been put out there so far, and she doesn't think there's any trouble for the president. And she's not coming at it from a political person. I don't even know what her politics are. I think she's been pretty open and honest about Paul Manafort doing things that should land him in jail. And she's been pretty honest and open, I think, in saying, hey, Michael Cohen, what he did, he was wrong too. And I think she's been pretty open and honest without having anything to do with politics, saying, yeah, Donald Trump right now isn't in trouble. Now, that doesn't mean that Democrats aren't going to go out of their way to try to take over the narrative, change the narrative, make it seem like the president is a lawbreaker. Understand, they're going after him because they don't want him running a successful reelection campaign. So they're going to put doubt in as many people's minds as humanly possible that he committed a crime. He committed a crime. Oh, and by the way, if you vote him out of office, progressives, you coalesce behind whoever's going to be our nominee. The second that he's out of office, he's going to be thrown in jail. Let's lock him up. They're very much aware of the irony. It's not lost on them. And that's what they're doing. And so if I was the president, based on what we know so far, I tend to side with Ann Bremner saying, yeah, I don't think he has anything to worry about. With that said, we don't have all the details. We're basing all of this analysis on what we currently know. And speaking of the narrative that progressives are trying to push, it's funny, Jeffrey Toobin, who's just the worst. He's the worst legal analyst. I'm glad we have Napolitano and CNN has Toobin. He's saying that this is very serious for Cohen, but also the president.
Well, you know, it's a serious sentence. Under federal law, you always have to serve 85% of what you get. So he's looking at least 2.5 years in prison for a white collar sentence. That's a lot.
And he was up for 5 years, by the way.
It is also a message that people around the president are going to prison.
That's the message. I mean, that's an observation, but you're saying the message is people are. How is that a message? You mean people who break the law go to jail, which is a message that has always existed. It exists in this White House. It didn't really exist in the Obama White House, but that's when progressives didn't care about the law. So let's stop this whole, the people around the president are going to jail. The ones who break the laws, yeah, they are. You do realize there are lots of people around the president that aren't going to jail, right? Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Let's get political.
So after negotiating with Nancy Pelosi, some of her big detractors, mostly some of the younger Democrats who are new, they came up with a significant win, it seems, a term limit deal for party leadership. The Hill says if approved in a caucus vote next year, it would allow Democrats serving in the top three leadership positions to serve three terms in each of those spots when they hold the majority, with a fourth term possible only if they get two-thirds of the support from the caucus. Now, Pelosi comes up with this because she doesn't care. After this term, you think she cares? After this term, she's going to be 213 years old. She's done. She doesn't care how she screwed over a whole bunch of other people before her. All the people are going to come after her. And what she's doing is, I think, she's selling out her younger colleagues who have aspirations to leadership, and that's a problem. Because here's the deal. While I understand why we may not want the same people in power for too long, that there is a sea of change that is hard to happen when you've got someone who's been in power for so long because they've created a lot of loyalty around them, they've also created a lot of knowledge. They know the system better than a new incoming House Speaker would, right? That's what I believe. Nancy Pelosi is in, from a understanding of how to work the system, I think the longer you've been in power, the better it is to that regard. And I think what also is interesting is talking about how this might impact the chairmanships. Representative Peter DeFazio, the Democrat from Oregon, told The Hill he could be on board for some term limits, but you got to think about them.
I'm agnostic. If the caucus were to do that, I would not object.
And what about a limit on Nancy Pelosi as Speaker?
I think if we limit chairs, then we ought to think about limits for the top jobs, too. I don't know what the term would be, exactly how many years, but, it took me 32 years to get to be a chairman. There's very few people who are going to hang around for 32 years.
He's so old.
To do that. And secondly, there's a question there. I mean, we've lost good people because they didn't see a way to move up.
I think there's some value in both sides of this. I'm kind of curious how you guys think. Send me a text, 1-800-465-877. It's an Unbitter Tax Resolution hotline. 1-800-465-877. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Wait, what?
So King 5 says a filmmaker who's documented the progress of this I-90 wildlife overpass, this bridge, he said he was over the moon when he saw footage of the first animal to use the bridge, which makes it seem like he's shocked that an animal would use the bridge that we just spent millions of dollars and countless hours on. Really? You're shocked? And we're getting excited over one? Seriously? Now, it was built east of Snoqualmie Pass. It's there because it wants to help animals pass over I-90 so they don't get hit by cars and, also so you don't hit them. And this is good. I mean, on paper, I like the project. I don't really like the numbers on how much money we spend on this thing. Ted Gradowski, he's the producer of a documentary called Cascade Crossroads, which sounds like the most boring documentary. My apologies to our friend Ted. He was so excited that the animal used it.
Oh, wow, it's over the moon.
Oh, my God.
And besides, the structure is finished, but they have not finished doing all the planting and all the landscaping on top there. So, really, the coyote is the first one to the party, and I think there's going to be a lot more coming once they complete everything in a couple of years here.
I thought we were killing coyotes because they're getting too close to people. Wasn't that a story? Didn't we do that last month?
And wolves.
Right, and wolves.
Yeah.
So what if all... be funny if all the animals are crossing and it's a trap. They're just going to kill them on the other side. This was actually put up, I guess, for red foxes because that is kind of endangered in this general region and they kept getting hit by cars and so now they can go over this little bridge. He says this is all going to help mitigate the effects of climate change and okay.
The reason why we're so excited is because this allows animals to move as climate change comes. We're feeling more of the effects of climate change.
I guess we're not really feeling the effects of climate change yet because one stupid wolf or coyote crossed only. So I'm throwing that out there. I mean, it's such a bad... climate change is so bad, all these animals are trying to move and one crossed the bridge. Maybe all the animals are skeptics.
It allows animals to travel freely up and down the Cascades.
Yeah.
This is an animal highway we're talking about here. And it allows the animals to go back and forth from the north to south Cascades without getting hit. It allows drivers to be driving across on the highway without hitting an animal and getting into an accident. So
I mean, it's well-intentioned, I guess.
So the animals are never going to try to cross the highway anywhere else now that this thing exists?
The thinking is the vegetation part is important because it's going to supposedly block their view of the traffic and kind of like force them into this clean path with grass. I mean, I hope it works. I don't want to hit like a little wolf.
Sure, yeah. Sounds great. But
what if this was the wolf that killed Little Red Riding Hood's whole family? All of a sudden, you do want to have a truck hit it. I'm just throwing that out there. Unintended consequences, Darren. Unintended consequences. It's time to... Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show, live in the Online Trading Academy studio. United Airlines, their flight attendants, are holding a strike this morning in Chicago, and they are upset with some cuts to staffing. Now, a strike at O'Hare can actually cause problems all across the country, especially if it inspires some more strikes across the country. Joining us live this morning with more is Fox News Radio's Jeff Manasso. Jeff, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jason. So first we should note that it's a protest because airline strikes are illegal. And it harkens back to the day when President Reagan fired all of those air traffic controllers who walked off the job, about 12,000, a little over 11,000. Who refused to go back to work and citing safety concerns and basically national security. The president said, get back to job or get back to work or you're off the job. And he fired them permanently.
Yep.
So this is a protest, United Airlines flight attendants protesting in one of areas throughout the world. 16 demonstrations were told, including here in Chicago. Where some 2,000 United flight attendants are based, and they're fighting staff reductions on international flights. The flight attendants union says that staffing cuts mean fewer jobs, and more importantly, could affect the safety of passengers. So what United's done is they've consolidated work, much like we see in corporate America, and heck, even our business, almost on a daily basis. And so. The flight attendants are saying this is United's greed that's taking center stage, and United says, look, we're just trying to, you know, keep in line with our competitors in terms of staffing efforts and streamlining hours worked and duties performed. But this demonstration today, it's a protest, and it's flight attendants that have the day off. It's union workers that have showed up, but working flight attendants, they remain on the job. And both the union and United says that this will not affect any customers. It won't have any impact on customers. And there will be no delays. There will be no cancellations. Because, again, these are flight attendants who are off the job today, scheduled to be off, who are showing up on their own time, which makes that a legal protest.
So what leverage do they have? Are they counting on bringing this up so the public gets involved and demands actions?
Well, that's a typical union tactic to get the media involved and to try and share their side of the story. Obviously, you have to balance it out with what United is saying, and not only that, but United, I talked to the managing director of global communications yesterday, Megan McCarthy, who also said, you know, we're working with flight attendants unions. We're working with our flight attendants to try and you know, come to a conclusion on this. But she also says that the airline plans to hire basically a hiring blitz next year because of the growth that United has experienced. So some 2,000 extra flight attendants will be hired for both domestic and international flights. But what they're doing, she says, is they're basically consolidating tasks aboard these international flights, and so in some cases, more than the X amount of flight attendants that they use are not needed.
Yeah.
So they're trimming those areas.
And we have heard other airlines doing something similar. I mean, it depends on the airlines and depends on the routes that they run and the size of the airlines. But I've got some friends who are flight attendants who have noted that, you know, they've had to take on more responsibilities. And it's an interesting bit, because if they don't make these changes, and we presume that the companies are being totally upfront, this is nothing to do with greed, Well, to pay for those extra flight attendants means we, as consumers, pay more for our flights, and then we complain when that happens. So it's kind of putting consumers right. in a little bit of a tricky position.
As a consumer in terms of air travel, I mean, we could, you know, I mean, the book's already half written on that, and it's not a good one. And, it's not a fun experience anymore flying. And, you know, flight attendants aren't there to give us snack packs and soft drinks. They're there to keep us safe. That's their primary position, to keep us safe. And sometimes, you know, people lose sight of that. However, if you look at this through the lens of a flight attendant, you know, the duties and tasks that they have to perform while trying to keep folks safe, even in emergency situations, for them, it's gotten to be a little bit too much, according to the airline, the flight attendants union, that's representing United Airlines flight attendants. So we'll see. You know, this is obviously a story that people are talking about. So, perhaps that will add some weight, to the flight attendants, in their argument, and maybe some, you know, somewhere down the line they can meet in the middle.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, we'll see, because, you know, get in line with people complaining about the fact that they have to do a little bit more work than they originally signed up for, because that's happening across the board in virtually every single industry. So, you know, best of luck to the flight attendants there. Jeff Manasso live from Chicago with Fox News Radio. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Jason.
You're listening to The Jason Rand Show, 1-800-465-8770 for your text. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. If you listen to the show, it should come as no surprise that free speech concerns are exceptionally valid when it comes to college campuses here in Washington and everywhere else across the country. Gonzaga bans Ben Shapiro, a professor, is held hostage for not supporting a student protest over at Evergreen. Both the First Amendment and the spirit of the First Amendment are under assault on college campuses. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, the FIRE, just released a study that actually says it's not nearly as bad as some of us think, but there's clearly some room for improvement. Joining me on the line from the FIRE is Laura Belts. Laura, good morning.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you guys just put out this study. It's a spotlight on speech codes. Speech codes generally mean any kind of regulation that a campus enforces that you believe goes a little bit too far. You outline them as green light, orange, or red light being the worst. What did you generally find?
Well, yes, we rate them on a kind of traffic light scale, mm-hmm. Based on First Amendment legal standards. So if policies aren't infringing on free speech, they get a green light. They get a yellow light if they're more vague or narrow restrictions, and then the clear and substantial restrictions on protected speech, they get a red light. And we found that the types of clearly unconstitutional policies are going down across the country through various efforts to get these policies changed, but there are still a lot of those vague yellow light policies on the books, and then there's quite a few, in fact, in the state of Washington.
Well, let's go through some of them in the state of Washington. For the most part, we'll focus on public schools, but it should be noted, private schools, while they generally can get away, unless they're in California, they generally can get away with policies that would be otherwise deemed unconstitutional, with the exception of when they put in their policies that they will protect certain types of speech, and then they go against it because they violated a contract. But here in Washington State, who are some of the offenders?
Well, Evergreen State, which you mentioned, of course, they get our worst red light rating. A couple policies from there. They tell students that they must be civil in all their interactions. And of course, that's a fine thing to suggest to students, but when you actually give that policy power behind it and say that they must be civil, that means that just about any kind of speech that the university disagrees with or thinks is too controversial could be sanctioned under that policy.
It's funny at Evergreen,
another
by the
one
way.
Because at Evergreen says they can only use two areas on the whole campus to hold a protest.
Well, and so that's the interesting thing, because it's funny for a college like Evergreen, where professors encourage students to speak out and protest. But protest, by its very nature, can be uncivil.
Right, exactly. And everyone's definition of what civility is varies, of course. And you're exactly right that often these conversations can get heated. When you're in the midst of an intellectual debate, there are going to be hurt feelings and people might get passionate about it. But that doesn't mean that speech can be sanctioned. And it certainly can't at a public university bound by the First Amendment.
Now, I expect everyone expects Evergreen high on this list. What else did you find in Washington?
Another school that gets a red light rating in Washington is Eastern Washington mm-hmm. University. They have an IT policy that says it's a violation of university policy for anyone to send annoying or offensive messages over their IT network. So again, these broad subjective terms like annoying or offensive, they can be applied to restrict just about any type of speech that is protected under the First Amendment. So that earns our red light rating.
Just joining me, I'm talking with Laura Belts from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, thefire.org. It's a wonderful organization that actually helped me when I was in college, and so I've been following them with great interest over the years. We're talking about the sort of the landscape as it relates to First Amendment rights on college campuses. We've been focusing a lot on Washington, but when you look nationally, there are some trends I've noticed, the same trends you guys have noticed, especially when it comes to quote unquote harassment or sexual harassment, when, you know, legally speaking, it's got a very specific definition. But when you look at some of the ways it's being interpreted by colleges, you find overly broad commentary on what is deemed sexual harassment.
Right. At Whitman College, which is a private college, but as you've noted, private schools that promise their students free speech are on the hook for that, and Whitman does. They define harassment as unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature, and they say that examples of sexual harassment include jokes, gestures, pictures, stereotyping, and these things could all be a part of a pattern of conduct that does constitute harassment. But when you list them out like that, saying that jokes are prohibited, students are bound to read a policy like that and think that they're prohibited across the board, and they may be worried about voicing their opinion, particularly if it's a controversial one, and they may self-censor themselves because of policies like this.
In your experience, what do you think the motivation is behind some of these policies? Is it to make everyone happy and try to get to a point on campus where no one is quote-unquote offended? Is it because they fear lawsuits? Is it because they have a nefarious take on all of this? Like, where do you think it's coming from?
I think it could be a little from column A, a little column B kind of thing here that it varies. A lot of times, honestly, colleges don't even know what policies are on the books. You have a situation where the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, where one department at a school will put out one harassment policy, and then the legal office has their official one, the residence hall policy has another definition of harassment. And so especially, I think, at the larger schools, you get this issue of having a bunch of policies defining the same term in different ways. It's really confusing for students, but that may be inadvertent. So that's a big reason why we maintain this spotlight database of school policies, in order to make sure that everyone's aware of what policies are on the books and what ones need to get fixed.
Well, and it goes even beyond them not realizing it. They sometimes use language that is just legally untenable. This whole idea of pushing back against so-called hate speech doesn't actually mean it. Hate speech is not like this legally enforceable term, certainly not in the ways that you're seeing. Clark University, you point out in this report, that their handbook says that bias incidents involve, quote, treating someone negatively based upon characteristics, including, by the way, telling jokes based on a stereotype or name calling. That's 100% protected speech, 100% of the time.
Right.
And yet you can't do that at Clark University.
Yes, we see those bias incident policies popping up everywhere across the country. And it seems to be a way that the universities are trying to respond to students' concerns about hate speech, you know, whatever that might mean to them since it's such a subjective, undefined term. But yeah, they direct their students to kind of report on each other and to survey each other and to report on any instance of hateful or biased speech. Even though that kind of speech, as you say, is protected by the First Amendment when standing alone. And so we've encouraged schools to instead use these policies to say, we'll offer support to students when they report these kinds of incidents, but we won't investigate or punish the alleged perpetrators, to turn it into a support system rather than a reporting and punishing system.
So the trend that we've seen over the course of the last few years, we are seeing it here in Washington. Gonzaga recently said, hey, you know what? We think that Ben Shapiro coming on campus is going to bring out protesters who are going to say mean things, and it's going to be expensive to handle security, so we're just going to say no to the event. And again, it's a college that's private, so they get to do that. But at the University of Washington here in Seattle, they said virtually the same thing for a previous speech against that the UW College Republicans wanted to have. And they sued, and they actually ended up winning. I mean, they ended up saying, the court saying, yeah, you can't just put these security fees that are incredibly onerous or just cancel them outright on a public campus.
Exactly. When a student group has invited a speaker to come in, the university must do everything in its power in order to get to allow that speaker to speak to the students. And we are finding that they're suddenly putting these vague security fees on speakers, saying, you know, your event is too controversial. We've heard a lot of fuss at other campuses where you visited, mm-hmm. so you're not allowed to come here. And that's simply impermissible under the First Amendment. And so what we encourage students to do in a situation like that, if a speaker is coming to their campus that they disagree with, we tell them that they should go out and throw their counter-protest and maybe hand out flyers, write an op-ed, hold another event, counter-programming. And that's how to respond to a speaker you dislike, rather than asking them to be disinvited or censored.
If you want to check this report out, it's at thefire.org. If you've got a kid who goes to college, maybe you're a college student yourself, if you've got a kid who's about to go to college, all of you in your family, including your kids, should make sure you bookmark thefire.org to find out exactly what's happening on campus and get help if you ever in a position where you need it. Again, go to thefire.org. My last question for you, what is, in your opinion, this is just you, what's the worst policy you've seen?
I think I dislike the policies the most that tell students that they have to have this long waiting period before protesting on campus. Some schools say it's 10 days, other schools say 2 weeks. It's just entirely unreasonable that any kind of expressive activity that a student wants to have on a public college campus has to have that sort of lead time. Because those are real policies, that 2 week one and the 10 day one. And so those really offend me the most, personally.
It's because you're an impatient person, clearly. For more on this,
no.
I'm with you.
News cycle, you got to get out and respond to events.
I'm just as impatient. Go to thefire.org right now to check out this report. The major takeaway for me was things are getting better, but there is still a lot of room for improvement, including and especially, I suppose, here in Washington State. We've been talking with Laura Belt from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Laura, thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show. Welcome back to The Jason Rantz Show, live in the Online Training Academy studio. See, the last segment we were talking about free speech on campuses all across the country and, of course, here in Washington State. And you wonder, how is it that so many college students are willing to just give up so much freedom and being able to express themselves in a way that they deem necessary and appropriate? And then you realize, you know, number one, they've got professors and administrators there who are coddling them, making it easier for them to give away their rights, telling them that you should never feel uncomfortable with speech that you don't like. And then they grow up and they get put in positions of power. they become congresspeople from California, like Representative Ted Lieu, who is a crazy congressperson who is a Twitter troll. That is what he's known for. He's known as being a Twitter troll, which is weird because after the hearing with Google, which he was a part of, talking about anti-conservative bias and the algorithm that maybe is suppressing certain kinds of speech, he goes on CNN and he says, oh, I would love to regulate speech.
I would love to be able to regulate the content of speech.
Just remember, this is a sitting congressman. A sitting congressman just said he wants to be able to regulate content online.
I would love to be able to regulate the content of speech. The First Amendment prevents me from doing so.
Aww.
And that's simply a function of the First Amendment. But I think over the long run, it's better that government does not regulate the content of speech. I would urge these private sector companies to regulate it better themselves. But it's really nothing that I believe government can do. And so that's been my position all along.
Gee golly, if only he were in charge. Well, how about this? Imagine the power to censor in the hands of your worst enemy, because you, Ted Lieu, are a dork who is a Twitter troll. Now, if I were to have the power to be able to regulate him out of his stupid tweets every single day, he would likely be upset. He would be incredibly upset. He would take a position that I would take if it happened to me, which is I have the right to say what it is I want to say and express myself. Well, then why are you so quick to want to take it away from others that you disagree with politically? Because that's really what we're talking about here. Ted Lieu is talking about taking away the rights of people he disagrees with. He bemoans the idea that he can't use the First Amendment to regulate speech, political speech, that might go against what he believes. We're in weird times right now, guys. We're in weird times. College campuses that are supposed to allow speech to flourish, ideas to flourish. Congress people who should understand the importance of free expression, a marketplace of ideas, they are creeping slowly, and in some cases not so slowly, into a tyrannical position of silencing speech they don't like. It's a lazy person's point. I'm not going to defend my position or explain why yours is wrong. I'm simply going to silence you. That's laziness. That's laziness. It's the kind of laziness we're seeing coming from Nate Silver, who at one point, 538.com, was supposed to be like this cool, nerdy place to go for just a data-driven analysis on a whole bunch of issues. Obviously leading by some of the polls and giving some analysis of the polls, but you were supposed to just get some basic facts and some deep dives. But now they don't do that anymore. In fact, he put out two tweets yesterday, and they're just so lazy and so stupid and weirdly not attached to any data whatsoever. He links to some story about so-called Republican obsession over Ocasio-Cortez, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democrat from New York, not really a Democrat, more of a socialist, but who could tell the difference nowadays? And he tweeted this. There are lots of reasons Ocasio-Cortez drives certain Republicans crazy, foremost among them, her race and gender. But it's also that she's quintessentially a New Yorker, and D.C. political culture is formal and prudish when New York City mostly isn't those things. Put differently, New Yorkers are very good at trolling, and Washington has extreme troll vulnerability. It's always made for a mismatch, but more pronounced now that we're in the golden age of trolling. We may need to move the Capitol back to Philly to keep it a fair fight. Okay. So this whole idea of the trolling, I guess I'll address it this way. Ocasio-Cortez, her trolling gets excused basically by Nate Silver, but Nate Silver gets mad at Donald Trump and his use of Twitter. His New Yorker attitude. Because that's where he's from. He's got a New York attitude. It's kind of crass. It's kind of low. It's kind of mean. It's kind of brash. Him, it's bad. Ocasio-Cortez, it's awesome. Give her a pat on the back. But this whole idea that first and foremost, people hate Ocasio-Cortez on the left, on the right, is because of her race and gender. It's stupid, lazy, political bigotry. And that really should come as no surprise anymore with Nate Silver, because that's what he does. That's what he does. And of course, he doesn't back it up with anything except for the stereotype that all Republicans are racists, sexists. There was a story the other day in the Federalist blog. Chad Green, who's been on the show before, he's a show friend. He took a position. He is openly gay. And he said he's experienced more negativity for being a gay Republican, or excuse me, just a Republican, than he has for being gay. And he pushed back against this notion that we live in a country where, you know, gay rights are under assault and everyone on the right hates gay people. That's not been his experience. And so Deadspin does this reaction to his piece and just says, you know, gay conservatives need to shut up. Again, going towards silencing people they don't like, silencing people whose positions they disagree with. And the truth is, Chad has more facts on his side than the folks over at Deadspin, than the folks like Nate Silver do. Because the truth is, if you do not buy into what the left believes, no matter what you identify as, they will attack you. Remember this whole idea of transgender rights. The second you find out that transgender person who's on the cover of Vogue magazine, who you said was so brave, as soon as she says that she is a Republican, oh, all of a sudden, we don't even mention her name anymore. Ocasio-Cortez, we're not obsessed because the media is turning her into the darling of the left. We're not obsessed because she's wrong all the time, like demonstrably wrong. It's because we hate the fact that she is a woman, that she's not white. But none of that, the left's bigotry completely ignored. They don't count you as black unless you believe in progressive causes. They don't count you as Jewish unless you believe in progressive causes. They don't identify you as transgender or gay unless you believe in progressive causes. There's no bigotry there. Cool. Got it. Thanks.